Okay, this is lecture number 5 in Apologetics 2. Lecture number 5 in Apologetics 2. We're talking about a brief history of apologetics. We talked about Augustine and his views, Anselm, Thomas Aquinas, Bonaventure, and René Descartes. Now, remember, René Descartes was about as close to a pure rationalist as you can get. In fact, he claimed to pretty much be a pure rationalist, although there were certain things that he held to in his thought that he could not prove rationally. But it was his system of thought. He was a French apologist. And it was his system of thought that Blaise Pascal was responding to. And with Blaise Pascal, a lot of people misunderstand Blaise Pascal and assume that he's bad-mouthing Thomistic-type arguments, arguments that Aquinas would present. In actuality, that's not the case. Pascal had a lot in common with Aquinas. There were some differences, and we'll talk about those. But it was pure rationalism, the idea that you can prove from, everything from your mind alone and through reason alone, and that you don't even have to deal with looking at the evidences of nature and empiricism and the data that deals with the five senses. Blaise Pascal lived from 16, this is on page 5 in that handout. He lived from 1623 to 1662. He was opposed to Descartes' pure rationalism. He realized that man is more than just a rational being. Some of the quotes, I'm just going to only bring up two quotes of his, but he's got some tremendous quotes. But I really recommend, if you get a chance, get his work, Ponce's. That's his defense of the faith. You see what he did? He pulled all these ideas together, and they were written on scraps of paper, and then the guy died. So he never did finish writing his defense of the Christian faith, so they just collected them. So it reads like Proverbs, like the book of Proverbs. It was just one-liners and two-liners and that type of thing. And so it is a book where you can just open to any page and then just spot read and that type of thing, whereas if you do that with Aquinas, it's going to kill you. Because Aquinas will spend 3 pages talking about an opponent's view. And so if you just spot read in Aquinas, you might think that this is his view, and it's the exact opposite view that he held. But he realized that man is more than just a rational being. To speak like Descartes, that man could find out everything through reason alone, and that man's reason was totally unbiased, was a misconception. Pascal stated this. He stated, "The heart has its reasons of which reason knows nothing." And what he meant by that was that the heart of man, and by the heart he meant a man's intuition, his knowledge of first principles. You see, if you try to prove everything through reason, the problem you would end up with is when you eventually get to your first principles, if you're going to prove them through reason, then you're going to have to prove those proofs through reason and on infinitely, and you're going to realize nothing in your system is proven. So we know certain first principles that we can't prove through reason, such as the law of non-contradiction. How do we know that it's something cannot be both true and false at the same time and in the same way? And if we can't prove that through reason, we're just left hanging. We need something more than just reason alone. But Pascal talked about the heart as the intuition. Man just intuitively knows certain things. His knowledge of first principles, the will, his emotions. All this is wrapped up. So man is not just a rational machine that makes all his decisions by his mind alone, by thinking alone. There's much more to man than just reason. And then Pascal argued in his Ponce's that pure rationalism leaves no room for revelation. Now think about that for a second. If René Descartes, who professed to be a Christian, if he was right and you can prove everything through reason alone, Then the question comes up, do you even need revelation from God? If you can prove everything through reason, why would you even need a Bible? And so what Pascal is arguing is that it's real, real clear that if pure rationalism works, there's no room for revelation, so it should be viewed as antithetical to the Bible, not compatible with the Bible. Now, he's not saying that reason is bad, but he's saying if truth can only be found through reason, that's what pure rationalism is, then that is opposed to the Scriptures. So Pascal's not saying throw reason out the window, but he's saying man does more than just reason. By the way, if it's too hot in here, if somebody wants to open a door and open some windows, go right ahead. Pascal was opposed to the traditional arguments for God's existence. However, if you read what he says very closely, it doesn't sound like he thinks they're not valid. It sounds more like he just figures, well, if you provide evidence for God's existence, the average person isn't going to be able to follow you anyway. And even if they are, and you convince them, 10 minutes later, he's going to forget all about it. And so he just figured, hey, we need to penetrate the heart of the man, not just the man's mind. We need to go beyond we need to go beyond pure rationalism. So what Pascal did was he figured, well, what is man concerned with more than anything else? What is fallen man concerned with? And he figured, well, the guy's concerned with himself. He's selfish, as all humans are selfish. Let's start with man himself. Now, I've referred to Pascal's apologetics as psychological apologetics, and Douglas Grotheiser did his doctoral dissertation on Pascal, refers to it as the same, but now he's starting to call it anthropological apologetics, and I think that's a good move, because I think it really zeroes in on the fact that Pascal starts with man. He starts right with man, and anthropos is the Greek word for man. But he starts with man, and he says that there is what he calls the paradox of man. Man is wretched, but he is also great. And he's got some phenomenal quotes. I wrote a paper on him that I presented at the Evangelical Theological Society. And some of his quotes are just tremendous on the wretchedness of man and the greatness of man. That man is wretched in that he's just a little dot on a planet that is just a little dot in the midst of this huge universe. And that the universe could crush man with just one. It doesn't have to gather together all its forces to crush man. All it takes is one little drop of water to crush man. But then Pascal says, yet that man is still greater than the universe, because the man knows that he's being crushed. The universe knows nothing. And so he recognized there was areas of man where, aspects of man where you could see that man was wretched or little or small, and other areas where man is great. He talked about the human condition, that when a person comes into life, you're basically on a one-way street to death. He explained this. He said, imagine if you were sitting down in a room next to a lot of other guys, and one by one, each guy was standing up to get executed and was getting slaughtered. And you knew that your number was coming up. Okay? And then Pascal said, this is the human condition. We're all born, and we all know we're going to die, yet we choose not to think about death. We choose to think about other things. So here we are. We come into life knowing that we're going to die, it's inevitable. And how do we deal with it? What is man's response to this hopeless condition? That man's he's a complex being that is both wretched and great, and part of that wretchedness is he knows he's going to die. And man's response to this, Pascal gives three different, in his pensée, he gives three different responses that man gives. Most of us give a little bit of each of these. You know, it's not like one man does. Takes one approach and another one takes a different one. But man's response to this hopeless condition is diversion, indifference, and self-deception. Diversion. What a man does there is he diverts his attention from something he doesn't like. He knows he's gonna die, and so Pascal argues, well, then so what does the guy do? He just goes out dancing. He spends all his time dancing or drinking or having a good time with anything to take his mind off the fact that he is mortal and the day is going to come when he is going to die. So it could be dancing, it could be sports, it could be your career, but we tend to get focused on something that is not as important, so that it diverts our attention away from the fact that we're going to die someday. Indifference. People are indifferent to eternal things, a lack of interest in eternal things. You can, in that paper I wrote on Pascal, the illustration to illustrate this point of Pascal's, what I mentioned was that you could take, you know, 80,000 people or 60,000 people at a football game, and when a touchdown is scored, it's deafening, the sound of the people cheering. Now put those same 100,000 people in a church, and even if they're Christians, you know, they might not even make a sound. And so it's just man's nature. A man in his fallenness, he has a lack of interest in eternal things and temporary things. The diversions of life are much more important than eternal matters. Self-deception, another way that man responds to this hopeless condition. He denies his wretchedness and denies his death. Pascal, his apologetic methodology is very biblical. He gets a lot of his information, a lot of his thinking comes straight from the scriptures. Here, Jeremiah 17, verse 9, about the heart of a man being very deceitful. You know, who can know it? And that's what we do. We deceive ourselves. We know we're going to die, but we keep telling ourselves we suppress that truth. Just like we suppress our knowledge of God, Romans 1. And we try to convince ourselves that we're not going to die, that we're really not wretched, that we're really not sinful, that we're really not imperfect. And so this was the basic apologetic method of Pascal. He starts from man. Now, Pascal did use historical evidences for Christianity as well. He was not against reason, but he was against using reason alone. And so he was willing to use historical evidences for Christianity. He would use fulfilled prophecies of the scriptures. And, you know, the Bible would make a prediction about a city or a place or about the Messiah. And then it would be, history would show it to be fulfilled, and he would say that this is evidence for the Bible being God's word. The history of the Jewish nation and their survival, though they were more persecuted than any other people on earth, Pascal would use that as evidence for the Christian faith. And then, of course, the miracles, the eyewitness accounts of miracles and the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. He used that as evidence for the Christian faith as well. And so Pascal is not... A lot of people try to give you this idea that Pascal was against reason and he was a fideist, someone who just says you have to believe by a leap of blind faith. That is not the case. He was attacking the pure rationalism of René Descartes. But once you put reason in its proper place, and it's one of the ways that man determines truth, but not the only way, then he's willing to use reason. And his ponce is a reasoned defense of the faith. But he refuses to use reason all by itself. He uses reason along with other arguments, such as historical evidences, and deals with man and argues from the human condition. Pascal's wager. Can anybody, not looking at their notes, can anybody kind of just sum up Pascal's wager for me? Anybody? Jeff?
You got a 50-50 chance, maybe there's a God, maybe there's a God. If you want to make the choice, you can choose God. And if you want to choose God, because if you don't deny there is no God, you don't lose anything. If you die and you choose God, you can lose.
Yeah. Good. good. Now, what I want us to note, recognize about Pascal's wager, this is not an attempt to prove God's existence. Pascal is asking people to wager their lives on God. He's talking, you know, in betting terms, in gambling terms, and he says you can't remain neutral. You have to either choose God or choose against God. To remain neutral is actually to choose against God. You forfeit your opportunity to choose God. But he's not trying to prove God's existence. What he's trying to do is he's just trying to get a guy to seek after God. And again, Jeremiah 23, verse 13, that scripture tells us that those who seek God will find him. If you seek God with all your heart, you will find him. And so, again, that's all Pascal is trying to do. He's trying to get a person. He's not saying, here, I'm proving to you that God exists. He's saying, look, you've got nothing to lose and everything to gain by wagering your life on God. So just all he's saying is live as if God does exist. Hang out with Christians. Go to their churches. Listen to the gospel being preached and desire that this God does exist, this God of Christianity. Because if he does, you could win everything. But if he doesn't, you're not going to lose anything anyway. And then, he brings up the other side of the issue. So Pascal's wager is not an attempt to prove God's existence. It is a plea for people to seek God and desire that he exists. Because Pascal knew from Jeremiah 29:13 that those who seek God with all their hearts will find him. Pascal narrowed down the two choices as this. And remember, if you don't choose, it's as good as choosing against God anyway. So everybody has to choose. And the only choices are, if you wager on God, if he exists, you win eternal life. But if he doesn't exist, you lose nothing. Okay? But if you wager against God, if he does not exist, you win nothing. But if he does exist, you lose everything. So, basically, what it amounts to is you've got everything to gain and nothing to lose by wagering on God. I mean, what if the atheist is right? What's going to happen if the atheist is right and he wagers against God? And then he dies. What did he win? You know, he won absolutely nothing. There's nothing that's won in that deal at all. So Pascal argues that the wise man will therefore wager that God exists because he has nothing to lose and everything to gain. Therefore, he will wager his life on God. Now, Pascal's assessment this is a quote from the Poncés. Because of the wager, now keep in mind that the wager forms the background for this statement. This is Pascal's basic conclusion. There are only two classes of persons who can be called reasonable. Those who serve God with all their heart because they know him, and those who seek him with all their heart because they do not know him. And so Pascal argued very convincingly that just because of the results that would follow, a wise man will desire that God does exist and will seek him if he does not know him. Now, the illustration of, there was a paper written for the Evangelical Theological Society defending Pascal's wager, and he used an illustration to show how rational that wager is. Suppose you're walking through. Suppose your child. Let's say you have a son, and your child got lost in the wilderness. And the experts are telling you, well, he's been out in that wilderness for 2 days now, and in the kind of cold weather that's out there, and without food, there's a good chance he's dead. It's only like a 50-50 chance that he's alive. Okay. Well, the father is going to want the rescue unit to continue searching for his son, obviously, if there's a 50-50 chance, okay? But you can take Pascal's wager and say, well, let's say there's only 1 in 1,000,000 chance that that kid's still alive. What would that father still desire? He would still desire that the search party continues to search for that child, because if the search continues and the child's alive and they find him, they win everything. But if the child's dead and they don't find him, they haven't lost anything. But the other alternative, the kid still is alive and they stop searching, the kid's going to die because of it. So again, it's a situation where there's everything to be gained and nothing to lose by wagering that the child is alive, and that's analogous to that God does exist. But that's Blaise Pascal, and I really appreciate the work that he did. It's a lot more... Think of Aquinas in the good sense. He's tugging at the mind of the man, whereas Pascal is basically tugging at the desires of the man, okay? And I think that's an apologetic method that we should look at nowadays, because today people are more concerned with themselves, their own death, the makeup of the human condition, than they are with rational abstract argumentation. Although I think there's always going to be a place for abstract argumentation. The only two other defenders of the faith that I want to bring up are Leibniz and William Paley. Now, Leibniz lived from 1646 to 1716. He used the ontological argument for God's existence, where from the idea of God, we could see that God must exist. And, we went over that. We discussed that when we talked about Anselm. And René Descartes also held to it, although Aquinas was opposed to this argument. And I'm not even sure where I stand on the ontological argument. But the main reason why I just want to bring up Leibniz is because on the cosmological argument for God's existence, now the cosmological argument is arguing from an effect to its cause, arguing that the universe or some element in the universe needs a cause, and eventually there has to be an eternal uncaused cause of all that exists, all else that exists. So the cosmological argument, though, the reason why I'm bringing up Leibniz is Leibniz made a twist of this argument from the principle that he called sufficient reason. Okay? There's three types of cosmological arguments, by the way. Three types you've got. The cosmological argument from existential causality. Rory, tell me who that is. That's Aquinas, right? Now, what the cosmological argument for existential causality, what that's arguing for is it's arguing that there are beings that exist that are contingent and dependent on other beings for their continued existence. So Aquinas wasn't arguing for God. The thrust of his argumentation wasn't for God as the cause of the beginning of the universe. He was arguing for God as the sustaining cause of the universe. Now, he wasn't denying that God didn't cause the beginning, but he was arguing that if God willed to do so right now, if he did not actively sustain you in existence, we would all go out of existence immediately. Okay? So he was arguing that God is the cause of our continuing existence. Okay? The argument from the Kalam cosmological argument. Anybody tell me who used that one? What Christian? Right, Saint Bonaventure. He used the Kalam cosmological argument. Who's named it to the probably the two leading proponents of this argument today? Moreland. Moreland, when he talks on the same topics as Craig, is is like a clone of Greg, but then when he makes an original contribution, I mean, he'll talk about stuff that nobody's talking about. But on the Kalam cosmological argument, we actually got that from Muslim philosophers who were arguing for God's existence. That argues that the universe had to have a beginning. So the Kalam cosmological argument is arguing that since the universe had a beginning, therefore it had to have a cause. And eventually you have to arrive at the uncaused cause, God who caused the beginning of the universe. So that's the Kalam cosmological argument. Well, the argument from sufficient reason, and by the way, I think I disagree. Geisler uses existential causality, but he brings in a premise that Aquinas wouldn't bring, the Kalam premise, later on in his argumentation. But Geisler doesn't like sufficient reason. He has two knocks on it. One is, he says that we need to find a cause in reality. We need to find a cause in the external world, or a cause existing outside the mind, rather than an explanation or reason existing inside the mind. And I think it's just because he's so Thomistic. You know, Aquinas, like Aristotle, had to start in the material world, or had to start outside the mind. And I don't think his point is that strong there. But also he argues that the thing is he makes such a big difference between a reason or explanation and a cause. Yet later on he says in his philosophy of religion work that they're interchangeable. They mean the same thing. But that's when he's trying to slam it for another reason, because. In the argument for sufficient reason, the final premise is not that God is uncaused, but that God is self-explained. Okay? Now, again, why is God? Why couldn't God not be self-caused? Because for something to cause its own existence, it would have to pre-exist its own existence to bring its own existence about. Well, that's ludicrous. You can't pre-exist your own existence. So self-causation is impossible. So Aquinas was really arguing that God is not self-caused, God is uncaused. But Aquinas worded it as God was self-existent, for by that he meant God is uncaused. But to be self-explained doesn't mean the same thing as being self-caused. And we'll take a look at that. I think it's a good argument. Yeah, let's take a look at the argument first before I explain that point. This is his argument, the cosmological argument for God's existence from sufficient reason. He argued that there must be an explanation for everything that exists. Okay? Now, obviously, right there you see that explanation is not being used identical with the word cause. Because, you know, to say there must be a cause for everything that exists, that would include God. God has no cause. But there must be an explanation for everything that exists. The things that exist in the universe are explained by other things. For instance, we need air. We need food, water. We need parents just to come into existence, okay? So Phil Fernandez's existence is explained by many different things. I would say, I am, because Joseph Fernandez and Angelina Menachino got together and had a baby boy called Phil. There's enough air for me to breathe and food for me to eat, and there's water and that type of thing. So the things that exist in the universe are explained by other things. Point three, adding all the things in the universe together will not give an explanation for the existence of the universe. So if you add everything that needs an explanation together, then the whole package still needs an explanation. Okay? Point four, there must exist some being which contains in itself the explanation for its own existence. Okay, and that would be God. This self-explained being is the explanation for all else that exists. Otherwise, there is no explanation why anything exists at all. Now, it's important to note that he would say that a self-explained being is a being that contains in itself its own explanation for its own existence. He's not saying that God is self-caused, He's saying that, you know, when you look at Gary, well, he is, because his existence is ultimately explained by God. And Rory, his existence is ultimately explained by God. And Phil, his existence is ultimately explained by God. But then you get to God, his existence is ultimately explained by himself. And what he meant by that is the fact that God is uncaused. I just exist. I am that I am. I am pure existence. I have no beginning and no end. You don't have to go anywhere else to find an explanation for my existence. So basically, to say that God is self-existent, or to say that God is self-explained, is not the same as saying God is self-caused. To say that God is self-explained is basically saying that God is uncaused. So I don't see the problems with this argument that he is. By the way, can anybody tell me a Christian, if he's still alive? This guy's way up in his 90s, but can anybody tell me a Christian who used this against Bertrand Russell in a debate? Right. The Jesuit priest Frederick Copleston, back in the 1940s, demolished Bertrand Russell in a debate on God's existence, and he used the cosmological argument from Sufficient Reason. William Paley, 1743 to 1805. The only reason why I bring him up here is because he used the teleological argument for God's existence. He was real famous for it. It's called Paley's Watchmaker. He argued that if you were walking through the wilderness and you came upon a watch, you would look at its complexity, its design, its order. You would see that it was designed for a purpose, even if you couldn't figure out what that purpose was. And therefore you would say, well, since it shows intelligent design, it must have been caused by an intelligent designer. Then Paley argues, I think he argues from the human eye, that when you look at the design there, we see that that must have been designed by an intelligent designer. It didn't get there by chance. Okay? With Mike McKenzie and John Gardner, when we went on our world religion field trip to Eastern Washington, we searched the entire mountainside for this one rock. You knew it was, or this hillside. It was like, I don't know, 95 degree weather. I was getting sunburned and everything. We were looking for hours for this one arrow, Indian carving on a rock. And now, obviously, when we found it and we saw that the arrow and stuff, that's real simple. That's not real. It's not highly complex, but there's enough order and design there for you to know that it was not caused by chance. It was an erosion that caused the shape of the arrow. So when you get something like the human eye or single-celled animal, contains enough genetic information to fill an entire library. How are you going to get that by chance? That's like the argument that that there's no way to produce a Webster's Dictionary from chance explosions in a print shop. Now, there's no way that could come about at all. So the teleological argument for God's existence, Paley's Watchmaker, is a strong argument there. Now, by the way, he was not the first guy to use a teleological argument. Aquinas, I believe it was his fifth way, he argued that things in nature work towards a goal. Mindless things in nature work towards a goal, like acorns always become oak trees. And when things work towards goal, there has to be some intelligence behind it, moving it in that direction, just as an arrow hitting the target must have an archer. And therefore, since nature works in accordance with, whereas evolutionists look at natural laws and try to argue, therefore God doesn't exist, Aquinas would say, no, natural laws are evidence that God does exist. Because nature makes sense and it has patterns and order and it is working towards certain goals. But even before Aquinas, you can find in many of the Greek philosophers, such as Aristotle, used teleological arguments for some concept of God. Now, those are the key Christian defenders of the faith that I wanted to talk about. What I want to do in the remainder of this lecture is talk briefly about, you know, we want to get an overview of the history of apologetics. It wasn't all defenders of the faith. There were guys who were opposed to it. And so I want to talk about some of the philosophers who attacked traditional apologetics. Immanuel Kant lived from 1724 to 1804. He basically stated that we can know reality as it appears to us, but we cannot know reality as it is. He argued that you don't really have this desk in your mind. What you have is a representation, a photo, if you will, of this desk in your mind. And there's no way for you to tell whether that photo that you have in your mind of the desk is accurate unless you take that photo and you put it side by side with the desk and compare it with the desk. Well, the problem is you can't compare it with the desk because all you get is another photo from your mind. And so he was saying there's a wall between reality as it appears to us and reality as it is. And we think there's order out there, but it's our minds reading into reality order, but that might just be our minds placing the order into it. It might not really be there. Now, with Kant and his argumentation, he argued for transcendental categories that were necessary for human knowledge. These are similar to the Platonic ideas. Remember, with Plato, you had a chair. That's a particular desk, that's a particular chair. But the way that we can identify them as chairs and as desks is because we have some concept, some immaterial idea, unchanging idea of chairness and deskness. And so Plato had these invisible, the world of ideas, that were more important and above the world of particulars. And it was a lot like that with Immanuel Kant. There was certain categories that were necessary for human knowledge, like space, time, and things of that sort. Kant argued that human reason, in order to function, accepts certain transcendental illusions as true, though they cannot be proved by reason. An example he gave is causality. When we see somebody punch somebody else in the nose and then that other person's nose bleed, we assume that the punch caused the bloody nose. Okay? But as David Hume argued, through sense experience, all you can really conclude is that many times when a fist makes contact with a nose at a high rate of speed, blood will be produced from that nose. So Hume would argue we know that A comes before B, but there's no way just through sense experience alone to prove that A caused B. So instead, in other words, Kant is arguing that when we see a fist hit the nose, we conclude, okay, that therefore the punch caused the bloody nose. But all we really know is first came the punch, then came the bloody nose. One followed the other, and there's no way to prove through experience alone that one caused the other. Now, let me say this. Let me go a step further, though. When the rooster crows and then the sun rises, most of us do not conclude that therefore the rooster caused the sun to rise. Okay? However, if you get a good rooster who's timing his real well, his crowing will be followed by the sun rising on a regular basis. But the fact of the matter is, our minds, we usually can investigate and look into a situation to see, hey, is this just a coincidence or is there really a cause and effect relationship? But basically, you cannot, by examining through data that you take in from the senses, through sense experience, you cannot come up with the principle of causality. The principle is already there. Okay? There are certain innate ideas. That's why I'm not a pure Thomist. Because Aquinas would argue that we get the principle of causality from sense experience, and I don't think that's the case. Kant argue that there's antinomies or contradictions that exist that cannot be reconciled through human reason. I don't want to go over the list of them. Yeah.
Well, if we can't know reality as it is, how did we know that it is true?
Well, there's a real simple refutation to Kant, yet at the same time, I'm not sure if it really holds. I don't know if it was Hegel himself or certain Hegelians, they would argue that the claim to know, the claim to say that man cannot know reality as it is to make a claim to know something about reality. Now, when Douglas Givet explained that to me in San Francisco at a meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society, actually we were in a cab at the time coming back from, or on the way to getting Chinese food, Winfried Cordovan, who co-authored Philosophy of Religion with Norman Geisler, Givet asked Cordovan to confirm that was a valid refutation of Kant. And he shook his head and said, he basically said, no, he didn't think so, because Kant is claiming that even that statement itself would probably fall in the transcendental realm. In other words, the transcendental realm of the ideas, we can know transcendental reality, but we can't know the reality outside the mind. He would put that in the other category, probably. Now, whether Cordovan is right or not, I don't know, but what I'm saying is, if that refutation does hold, it would take a lot more study of Kant and a lot... It's not just a black and white issue. It's more complex because he can put certain things that he claims he knows in the transcendental realm, which would take it out of the other category. But he said there were certain contradictions that exist that can't be reconciled through human reason. What he was arguing was that in order for us to reason, we have to assume certain things are true without being able to prove them, and sometimes the things that we have to assume to be true are contradictory. Okay? He would claim that we'd have to assume that the principle of causality must hold, yet the universe exists without a cause, or some things that I think Geisler is correct in just basically saying that some people either don't see what he's calling contradictions as really contradictions, or they only believe and assume one of the things to be true and not the other one. But it's not really this great big problem that Kant held to. But basically what he was arguing that through pure reason we could not prove God's existence. He was arguing that basically all reason can prove is things as they appear to you, not things as they are. So there'd be no way whatsoever to prove if God really did exist. Yeah, Jeff.
When you were a theist,
he was a theist, and we'll see that from the very next point. But I wouldn't call him. Definitely, he's not an evangelical Christian, and his philosophy was of higher importance to him than any sacred book such as the Bible. But that's the next point. He said, even though we couldn't prove God through pure reason, still we must assume God's existence and life after death if we're going to make sense of our sense of morality. So in other words, he argued that through pure reason you couldn't prove God, but we should assume that God exists through practical reason. In other words, it's a moral argument for God's existence. What he's saying is, look, there's no way we can prove with our minds alone that God exists. At the same time, if we go around telling people, therefore he doesn't exist, then we're going to be killing each other off. If there's no life after death and a God who's going to punish or reward us, then it makes no difference whether you live like Mother Teresa and you feed the hungry, or Adolf Hitler and you butcher people to death. There's not going to be any punishment or reward. And so basically he argued that we should assume God's existence in life after death, and then it does make sense for us to say some things are wrong and other things are right. Yeah.
Would you say the Father is real or the
absolute? I would say that, I would say he definitely had some type of influence on it, but that was more Kierkegaard than Kant. But I would say, if there's a million branches that come to Kant, and there might be, Kant is basically the father of modern thought. I mean, what you have is René Descartes, classical rationalism, the idea that through reason we can prove everything and we can know things with rational certainty. That was René Descartes. That's where you had all these atheists coming up, and then you even had, Descartes was trying to prove God, but then you had backfired, and you had a guy like Spinoza who claimed he had proved that the universe is God, and then you had atheists come on the scene, and man had elevated human reason so that we could say where the errors were in the Bible, and the Bible really wasn't God's word. Well, Immanuel Kant then came on the scene and said, hey, wait a minute. There's problems with this pure reason. You might think that you can find out everything with certainty.